Ganley, this is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In Japan, they're called parasite singles. In Italy, politicians lament the culture of mamissimo, or mama's boys, while in the U.S., headlines blast the slacker generation. All descriptions of a recent trend, more and more young adults living with mom and dad. In this country, the number of parents sharing a home with adult children has risen from 2 million to almost 3.5 million over the past decade, a jump our guest today calls astounding. We're talking with sociologist and author Catherine Newman. Her new book, Accordion Families, chronicles this trend in several industrialized nations. And in all of them, she says, the economic forces driving this demographic train are similar: a tough job market, high costs of living, and huge debt loads for college grads. But depending on the country, Newman finds different reactions to it. In Japan, older generations are horrified. In Italy, they accept it and often welcome it, while the U.S. seems somewhere in the middle. Newman's book brings us into the homes of these accordion families and tells their stories, but she also draws connections between these individual household decisions with larger public policy concerns on what this failure to launch young adults from the nest means for these nations' economic and demographic futures. And that's what we're talking about today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. What do you think is behind this trend? Is it all economics, or have our views of what's acceptable changed? If you're in one of these accordion households, parent or adult child, tell us your story. What led you to this arrangement? What are the pluses and minuses of it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Catherine Newman, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Nice to be with you.
Well, before we get into all that's changed, Catherine, just describe, if you could briefly, that familiar, traditional, middle-class pattern of launching a young person from the nest out into the world.
Well, you said it. Once upon a time, when you turned 18, you packed up your bedroom, you went off to college, and you didn't come back. You spent some time with roommates, you looked around for your life partner, eventually you settled down, started a family of your own. All this has changed now. Something like 85% of the nation's college graduates come back to live with their parents for a period of time. They have often not completed their education, but finally have to go back to get more schooling at master's degrees, professional schools, in order to become the middle class people they want to be. Meanwhile, mom and dad don't become empty nesters. The nest fills up again. And they spend many more years in active parenting, although it's qualitatively different because that 25-year-old isn't the same as the 15-year-old they let go. So the pattern by which people achieve adulthood has become elongated. The signs of it are different and more vague. And all of this is tied up with how the labor market is treating new entrants. And it's not a pretty picture.
Well, and we'll definitely get into that this hour. But one more quick question. What are the class differences in this traditional model that you outlined?
There are significant class differences. People in the upper reaches can afford to help their children live independently by subsidizing their costs, paying their rent, and cover their college tuition. You get down into the middle class, and it's looking a little more strained. Now kids come back in order to shelter some of those living expenses. Their parents are probably still paying for the advanced educational costs, but they're trying to save a buck or two by keeping under one roof. Now we get down into the working class, and now those are kids who probably didn't leave home at all. They went to junior college. They went to schools that allowed them to live at home, that were nearby. They worked. They probably didn't go to school full time. It took longer to finish their college degrees. And so their pattern is different because they're not a boomerang. They just don't leave to begin with until they're quite a bit older. Then we get down into the nation's poor households, and it's even more strained. The college possibilities are much more limited. They're likely to live at home much longer. And instead of being able to earn money to take care of themselves and save to become independent, they're being asked to contribute that money to the central household coffers. So there are huge class differences in how these labor market dynamics are playing out.
Well, and you hinted at when it started to change, but give us a little more, Catherine. So when roughly do we see these traditional patterns of launching from the nest starting to change, and how come?
I think that we can really date this change to the early 1980s.
But that far back, really?
Yes, it's not a trend that was created by the Great Recession, though it is intensified with the recession because now you've got people who are coming back home for lots of other reasons. They've lost their jobs, they've gone through a divorce. Now families are starting to double up because of these extraordinary economic hardships. But the patterns affecting young people actually got started quite some time ago as the demand for a lot more higher education began to creep into the trajectory toward a professional occupation. It was not very noticeable in the 80s. It really started to accelerate in the 90s, and now we've seen a big jump, which is exacerbated by the recession. So I would say this is what we in the business call a secular trend. It's a trend that's developed over time, but it is certainly accelerated. And one of the reasons it began in the 80s is that in a lot of countries we started to see outsourcing, downsizing, the eruption of temporary jobs, what we call contingent labor. And that had a powerful effect on new entrants to the labor market, and that was mainly young people.
You know, and you talk about the tough job market, especially for young people, and we definitely see that in the data. And yet, you know, I've been hearing lately, at least here in New Hampshire, Catherine, that there are good jobs available, but young adults don't have the skills needed to fulfill them. So I wonder if this is really an economic problem or an education problem or a little bit of both.
It is definitely a little bit of both. Good jobs do require a lot more education, and that in turn is quite expensive. And in fact, it's getting more so because under the pressure of the recession, states are cutting back their subsidies to public higher education, which is causing the cost to increase as universities increase tuition. So the demands for more education are growing, and it's becoming more costly. The loans that students are taking out then are more burdensome to them. They're coming on to require repayment much sooner than they did in my generation. And so it's not that there aren't young people who are qualified, it's that it takes much longer and costs much more to get there because we are in an economy that is rewarding the high-skilled at an outsized level.
And we all know the costs of college and the debt loads that American students take on are huge, and that's definitely driving this this boomerang trend. What about the other countries, though, Catherine? I mean, in Japan and Italy and Spain and some of the other countries that you looked at, do their young people also incur huge college debt, or is that not a problem they have to worry about?
They also actually can't because there's no money available to provide them with much in the way of loans. So that's one of the reasons why they don't go away to college. In those countries, in general, people go to college wherever they grew up. They just have to hope that the local university will take them and that they'll be able to study what they want to study living nearby because they just don't have dormitories. In many of these countries, they have very limited rental properties at all. So you can't move out because the only kind of place you can live is an owner-occupied house. So this tends to lead to much longer periods of time in the natal home for young people, especially in Southern Europe, which has a tradition of very weak welfare states. If you look at the Scandinavian countries, it's exactly the opposite. They don't have the accordion family at all because they provide very generous college benefits. Basically, higher education is free in the Nordic countries, and they have very large rental sectors, very heavily subsidized housing, very generous supports to the unemployed, including young people who've never worked at all or hardly worked at all. So in the Nordic countries, they've made a decision at the public policy level to support youth independence. And this is not because their young people have an easier time in the labor market. They have very high youth unemployment just like we do. But their policy response is very different. So in Europe, we tend to see in the Southern European countries and in Japan, very elevated rates of accordion families for a much longer period of time than we have. In Italy, 37% of young men age 30 have never left home.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was stunned by that. I mean, not just 20-somethings, 30-somethings.
Yes, and this is becoming more and more pronounced. In Japan, they're now talking about this sort of generation starting to attach their parents' retirement income because they're now in their 40s. This because Japan started through an economic slowdown several decades ago, and these lousy job contracts that were part-time, short-term, began to infect the youth labor market more than 20 years ago there.
Well, in fact, the money section of USA Today just yesterday had an article about financial advisors are concerned that middle-aged Americans are sacrificing their retirement savings to fund their kids' launch into the world. So there's a cost there to this.
there's a huge cost, and it's going to follow them for the rest of their lives. Of course, I think, you know, the flip side of this is that Americans do have a kind of intergenerational social compact that you help your children, you help to launch them, and if you need their help someday when you're elderly and frail, one hopes that, what goes around comes around. But it is certainly taxing the resources that the retirees need to husband for themselves, especially if we're going to face increasing health care costs. Now, when we add in a cratered housing market, you see how serious this problem is. Because what most American retirees were using to fund their retirement and health care costs was the equity in their houses. So they could afford to help take care of their kids because they had that nest egg waiting for them. Well, they don't anymore. So this is, you know, all the way around, the accordion family is the adaptation. It's the safety, private safety net, or the sort of cocoon that people are turning to try to manage what is a really very gigantic demographic and economic squeeze.
Well, and you talk a lot about the economic forces behind this, Catherine, but there's another component that gets a lot of attention. We hear about parents coddling their kids, not wanting them to have to work at a less than perfect job or live in a crummy apartment and eat ramen noodles. I mean, how much is this failure to launch, Catherine, due to parents being soft?
Well, this is a debate in many of the households that I interviewed for this book. Some parents are very worried that they are indulging their children and setting up expectations that are not realistic, because we're in a great recession and it's not a happy time, and there are going to be diminished opportunities, and expectations will have to diminish, and they worry that they're not introducing their children to the real world as it is. That said, I feel that that explanation is often overblown. It's turned into a pathology, as if there was nothing for them to worry about. But of course there's something for them to worry about. There's a reason why they've spent north of $200,000 to put their kids in private universities. They're trying to advantage them in an increasingly competitive labor market. And isn't that what parents are supposed to do? But it's not working, because that labor market's not working for them. So to criticize parents for caring about their children's long-run lives, I think, is misplaced. It's part of their job.
And we will definitely talk more after a short break and take your calls, too. So join us with your own experiences at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. Support also comes to us from the McLean Law Firm and its tax department, representing businesses and individuals on a variety of tax-related matters, online at mclane.com. And the New Hampshire Society of Accountants, helping you find a tax accountant for your personal or business needs. New Hampshire Society of Accountants, online at nhsacct.org. More on young adults returning home on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather for today, becoming partly to mostly sunny across most of the state. High temperatures 35 to 40. Cloudy, a chance of snow showers for the North Country today, with highs there 25 to 30. Tonight, partly cloudy for most of the state, with low temperatures 20 to 25. Mostly cloudy in the North Country tonight, with low temperatures from 10 to 15 degrees. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Catherine Newman, author of the new book, The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. Newman is also the James Knapp Dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences and a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Her book looks at the rising trend of young adults moving back in with mom and dad. Give us a call if this describes your family. If you're living in one of these accordion households, how do you feel about it? What were the circumstances that led to this situation, and how's it working out for you? Even if you're not part of an accordion family, what do you think is behind this trend? Is it all economics, or have our views of what's an acceptable path to adulthood changed? Let's hear from you this hour. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Catherine, before we go to the phones, just picking up on that point we were making before the break, you were strongly disagreeing with this feeling that part of the failure to launch is due to parents being soft. But you do write that many young adults are only too happy to live in the nice house with the nice TV and good food, and if they're lucky, maybe mom does the laundry too.
It is certainly true that the expectations that young people have for their standard of living now are higher than they were, say, when I was 18, and there was a tremendous amount of cultural support in that sort of, I don't know, counterculture generation for living with jeans with holes in them and, you know, sort of more or less enduring any kind of slump in the standard of living just to be independent. Being independent and autonomous was the highest value. I think that was an aberrant generation, actually. If we look before it and we look, especially if we look after it in the early 1980s, when we start to see the return of greater expectations for affluence, we do start to see changing cultural tastes. So it is entirely possible that if young people were willing to double up, triple up, eat ramen noodles, live in a pretty dicey neighborhood, that they might be better able to be independent. It's not clear to me that they could do that and save for a master's degree that's going to cost them $25,000 a year. So this is partly about taste. It is partly about expectations. But it's also about the high cost of achieving a professional career track. And that's why I don't think we should overblow it. It's there. There are changing tastes in American generations. But it's not the whole explanation, and I think it's letting the economy off too easily to just say this is inflated expectations, or if they weren't willing to go out to dinner, they wouldn't be in this situation. I think that's too silly.
So I graduated from college about 25 years ago, in that more traditional pattern for sure, with the group house and the ramen noodles and, you know, and whatever. So you're saying it's not fair to apply that model that perhaps you and I had because the economic situation is so different today? Is that what you're saying?
It's not a question of what's fair. It's a question of trying to understand what are the components that lead to an accordion family. Part of it is taste and the expectation of a certain standard of living. A lot of it is the extraordinary cost and demand for achieving higher education or internships. I mean, employers are expecting to see a very experienced group of people at their doorstep. They can choose and be very choosy about it, whoever they want coming in the front door, because there is such a huge surplus of young people looking for these job opportunities. So under those circumstances, if you have to have several years of entirely unpaid work in order to qualify for the sort of job that you were looking for, then somebody's got to pick up that slack, and it's not a simple matter to afford that. And then we get into all the inequalities you mentioned before. Some families are much better able to shelter those costs than others, and that will have an effect on who really gets to work toward those professional careers. Everyone, or just the people whose families can let them work for nothing for a couple of years.
So it's kind of an unfair advantage.
Well, yes. I mean, there are unfair advantages laced throughout our economy, and we've known for some time that people who are fortunate enough to have chosen their parents well, you know, are advantaged. We certainly believe, I think, in meritocracy. I don't think anybody thinks this is good, that people who are very talented but just happen to come from families that can't afford to let them work for nothing for several years might be closed out of these opportunities. But I think we have an alarm bell to sound there, because I think that's exactly what's going on.
In trying, though, to make life easier, maintain that standard of living, and yes, Johnny, you can have, you know, that internship and live at home for free, are parents denying Johnny the opportunity to learn life lessons? You know, what it means to budget, what it means to eat peanut butter, you know, for dinner.
They certainly,
you know what I'm
I saying? Say
I mean, you're missing something there.
Yeah, without, you know, passing judgment, which isn't really my occupation exactly, I would say that many parents are worried about that. They can't easily determine the balance between helping their children to achieve goals that the whole family endorses and sheltering them too much from the harsh realities of life. I mean, we are in a truly historic downturn. This is way worse than anything anyone has had to confront since the 1930s. That's not just a little blip. That's a very significant departure from what any of us expected or wanted. How much of the brunt of that should we let our children feel? And how much of that should we try to shelter them from? And how much of a cost should we pay in the comfort of our own retirement to make that possible? I don't think that there are easy answers to these questions, and families really differ about it. And I don't feel the need to be particularly prescriptive about it. I just think it's important to recognize that these costs and these luxuries are all hanging out there, on the backs of one generation that had the unfortunate experience of entering the labor market in the worst condition it's been in since the 1930s. Whose fault is that exactly?
Well, let's take some calls, Catherine. And our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Join us if you're a member of one of these accordion families that Catherine Newman writes about, or more broadly, even if this does not describe your own situation, what do you think's behind this trend? 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Eric in Portsmouth. Hi, Eric. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air. And we've lost Eric. I hope he'll call back. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email, Catherine, from Patrick in Dover, who says, a lot of my friends and I graduated last spring. I'm living on my own, but I have a few friends living at home with their parents after graduating college. Most of us have to pay back loans, including myself. My friends that live with their parents after graduating, even after having a job that pays far less, are saving more money than me because living with their parents helps to save on expenses. Patrick says, I think people in America should embrace this because it gives recent grads an opportunity to build credit and save money. Obviously, they shouldn't be living in their parents' basements until they're 34, but a few years at home can be reasonable without being a slacker. What does your guest think? Patrick, great comments. Thanks for the email.
Well, I tend to agree with Patrick, and more to the point, I think many of the families I interviewed agreed with Patrick. They are trying to navigate between a sense of stigma that this is somehow isn't the way it ought to be, and somehow young people should be able to do the impossible, and their understanding that it isn't really possible, and this is what families are for. Part of the purpose of the family, at least as we think of it in the United States, is to help the next generation and put them in a more advantageous position. I mean, after all, why were we investing in them all those years to go to college, only to see them take a job flipping burgers? I mean, that's really not what the idea was, and that might be all they can do unless they're able to get more education and prove on the promise of that very deep investment. So I agree with him, but I think many families are trying to navigate a truly significant cultural shift, and they've got two generations side by side with very different economic histories, and they're trying to sort out what's right, what's fair, what's smart, and what's beneficial in the long run.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Two generations living side by side with different economic histories, and they're trying to sort it out. That kind of sums it all up, doesn't it?
I think so.
Let's go back to the phones, and our number, 1-800-892-6477. Jan's calling from Plymouth. Hi, Jan. You're on the Exchange.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say that without judgment, I know it's a different time for these kids now. I have three daughters, and all three of them have substantial debt. None of them want to come and live with me, and they don't hate me at least once a week. I think I haven't done something right. But I remember, you know, in the early 70s, I think I would have lived in my car before I went home to live with my parents, and I ended up losing a job. And the other night watched a documentary, and at the very end of the documentary, these two lawyers were sitting there talking to each other, and they were both female. One of them said to the other one how tired she was because she'd been up all night typing her kid's college application. I never typed an application for my kids. These helicopter parents kind of do need to stand back and let their kids suffer through some of that stuff. You know, I remember sleeping with my clothes on and eating the popcorn and even hitchhiking to work in Chicago. When my parents found out, they were furious that I hadn't let them know how tough it was at the time and why didn't I come home. And I said, well, I was afraid you'd make me come home.
Well, so you learned some lessons there, Jan, right?
Of course I did.
Right.
And I lost the job during that downturn in the 70s when you stood in line for gas. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's not a different time. It is. But I know a lot of helicopter parents and a lot of kids who think they have to have everything that we have, and they want it now rather than, you know, the plywood table with the cinder block bricks, you know.
Jan, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, as I said, that, you know, times have changed, and I also, you know, lived out of a car and lived in some pretty scary neighborhoods and hitchhiked to work and had some pretty scary experiences along the way. So I'm very aware of the change your caller is describing. I guess I want to avoid stigmatizing parents who possibly are going somewhat overboard, but the competition they see their children facing, the anxieties they feel about their futures are real, and there are good reasons for it. When I applied to go to college, it was not an easy time, but it was nowhere near as competitive as it is now. And I say that as a dean of a good university. The competition is ferocious. We have here at Johns Hopkins 20,000 students applying for essentially 800 positions in our class.
Wow.
That's not what it was like when I was entering college. So, well, it's true we don't want parents typing their children's applications. We do understand, and I think any capable administrator does, that there are reasons for them to be concerned about the competition their children are facing. And the rewards to getting into this university are so enormous relative to other possibilities that are less desirable to them that, of course, they're trying to advantage their children. So I guess I'm trying to skate a balance between accepting the critique that your caller offered, that we can go overboard and ruin our children's adaptive capacities to do for themselves, and the recognition that there are real reasons why people are anxious, and they're not imagining this.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Jan. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Bob's calling from Concord. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I'm just curious to the downside. I didn't really hear a lot of the beginning of the program. I'm at work. And a daughter right now is in Tanzania, in Africa, and we miss her terribly. And when she finishes school, she's hoping to go to graduate school and possibly live with us. And we think it's wonderful. She's an only child, and she does her own laundry. She does her own application. She does all that stuff. So I'm sort of wondering, I mean, I grew up in Boston, and I could tell you a million stories about near-death experiences. And I don't want her to live in one of those neighborhoods just to see what it's like. Or just to get tougher. I mean, she's doing something now that I never dreamed of doing, going to a semester in Africa. So I'm just not sure the downside of her staying at home, being independent, living her life, just in us helping out with shelter. I'm just not sure of the downside of that.
So you're seeing an upside to your daughter hopefully coming home and living with you. And,
yeah.
and this independent living that you and I think Catherine did and Jan did, well, let's not romanticize it, Bob. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, basically, yes.
Thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, I think that he's very typical of many of the people I interviewed, and they're sort of almost trying to puzzle through why they're so happy about it, because it does contrast sharply to their own experience. But in fact, many parents not only want to protect their children from what they could only afford to provide for themselves, but they actually rejoice in their return. And there are several reasons for that, I think. One is families are smaller, so they're not one of five where you've got lots of kids running around the house and this one, you know, goes off on their own. They're one of two or maybe one of one, and the house can get lonely and too empty too fast. There's another reason, and that is that if you look at this generation of parents, they worked all the way through their children's young years, their mothers and their fathers. By the time those kids turned 18, their parents were not tired of them. In my generation, you know, many of us were raised by stay-at-home mothers, who by the time we were 18 had sort of had enough. I mean, they loved us enough, but, you know, enough already. They wanted to move on and do other things. But mothers and fathers today have spent so many years trying to balance work and family that they really didn't have enough time with their kids. Moreover, there's not much of a cultural gap between them. When I was growing up, my parents had very different tastes in music and entertainment than I did, but my tastes and my children's tastes are very similar. And if you go to a Rolling Stones concert, you've got gray hairs and 20-somethings on the dance floor because we tend to like the same music, we're interested in the same films. You know, we were all told that when Barack Obama was elected, very often that was young people coming to their parents and asking them to take a look at him. Their politics aren't even necessarily all that different. Well, so that great generation gap that defined the gap between World War II era parents and their baby boom children, that gap doesn't exist between today's parents and their Gen X or millennial generation kids. So it's much more comfortable. They get back a kid who doesn't need to be surveilled, who's doing their own homework and dishes. And so all those unpleasant aspects of parenthood, is Johnny home by midnight, has Mary done her homework, all that's gone. And what you get are all the pleasurable aspects maintained, the friendship, a more egalitarian relationship, a cultural similarity, the house fills back up again and it's not so quiet. And so I think this is a changing norm.
Well,
I do think more parents are starting to think the way Bob does.
Bob, thanks a lot for calling, and good luck with your daughter's time in Africa. Let's take another call. Catherine, this is Nick in Pembroke. Hi, Nick. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
I was calling because I had a comment. I actually came from an accordion family. I'm 28. I lived at home for almost 6 years after college. And I do think that sometimes kids do not get the push that they need, actually. My parents coddled me for like 6 years, and finally they said enough is enough. And they said, you know, they gave me the nudge out of the house saying, you know, you need to be out by a certain point. And I do think that kids need that in order to experience life on their own. Because for me, I would never want to go back after I've gotten out of the house. So that was just my general comment for you guys.
Hey, Nick, I'm glad you called. So what made you go back to your parents' house after you graduated from college? You said from like 22 to 28, you lived at home.
Yes. I was a Keene State College graduate with a major in theater. And the thing is that I don't think it was a career that I chose that there was a lot of a future in.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's the hard thing for college students now too, is that when I went to school, and this was back in 2006, there was a lot of focus on pursuing your dreams and doing something that, you know, you really like to do versus something that was necessary for yourself. So I think that if I could go back and do it over again, I would do something that would be more necessary and more relevant to today's economy that I could get a job at.
And Nick, how did it feel when your parents said, look, enough is enough, we love you, but you got to get out of here? How did that feel?
I mean, at first it was very hard. I mean, you know, for any child that had their parents say, you know, get out, we're giving you this time frame, you have to be out by this certain point. But and of course I was like angry and like, you know, like any other child would be. But then after the fact, once I got out, I realized that they were right. I mean, you know, and I sincerely thank them for it now, because I'm like, you know, if they hadn't given me that nudge, we'd probably still be living at home.
All right. Well, Nick, it's great to hear from you. Thanks a lot. And good luck.
No problem. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Catherine, I'll get your thoughts on that after a very short break. Our number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Well, as we're hearing, tell us your stories about accordion families. If you're a 20 or 30-something living at home, or an adult or a parent with an adult child living under your roof, what led to this situation? How do you feel about it? Even if you're not part of an accordion family, what do you think is behind this rising trend of young adults returning to the roost? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
By now, you know you can donate your old car to NHPR, and you know how easy we make it by filling out the paperwork for you, picking up the car, and auctioning it off. But what you may not realize is that we accept more than just cars. You can donate anything to our vehicle donation program, from a snowmobile to an RV to a boat. Find out more at nhpr.org or give us a call and get the process started at 1-877-393-NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Sulloway & Hollis, providing legal solutions and effective advocacy for healthcare organizations and professionals, schools, and businesses throughout New Hampshire. And from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, for any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the author of a new book called The Accordion Family, on the dramatic rise in young adults still living with mom and dad. Join us with your questions, comments, personal experiences at 1-800-892-6477. Catherine Newman is our guest. And Catherine, before we return to the calls, I'd love your thoughts real quick on Nick's point. He says, hey, I lived at home for 6 years. Glad they gave me that push out the door at 28.
Well, I think it's very important for families to be clear about what the rules of engagement are. What should each person be contributing to the household while they are living there? If there's an end point, either because parents think that their children need some discipline in all of this, or their own resources would be exhausted in some way, they need to be clear about it up front. I think the mistake comes when people just feel aggravated in a private and quiet way, and then it erupts into a confrontation or a rude slap in the face of, you know, we don't need you here anymore, go be on your own. I think if people can be open about it and set their expectations out, it avoids a lot of tension And then everybody knows what the ground rules are. And those ground rules are going to differ by family circumstances and parental tolerance and young people's own behavior. And that's probably not something we can legislate.
Let's take another call. This is Sarah in Concord. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to The Exchange. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I was raised by parents who taught me how to budget money and how to do for myself. And when I was graduating from college, I also graduated like you, Laura, about 25 years ago. My mom gave me an article in the New York Times that was about a study that had been done showing that there was a very large gender difference between in this phenomenon. So many more girls were moving out and getting jobs and living on their own as compared to young men. And I certainly found that this was the case when I was graduating from college in 1989. All of my female friends, we were all moving out and finding jobs, and all the young men I knew, even men, young men who had jobs and were making more money than I, were living at home. So I just wondered if any of your guests know if there's been any recent research and whether this gender gap still exists, this phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a great question, Sarah, and one I had as well. So thank you. Catherine, what'd you find?
There is a gender gap, and it has multiple sources. There always has been a gender gap because young people, women, got married at an earlier age than men, always, and so they were always leaving home sooner than their male counterparts. But I think there is a point here that is really serious. You know, when we look at how the economy is advantaging people with higher education, and then we look at how successful girls are in education all the way. I mean, at every level, girls are outstripping boys. And so, you know, for many years we worried about gender equity and problems for girls, but, you know, lurking underneath that all this time was really a trend going in the other direction. We have much higher rates of college going for young women than young men. This varies to some degree by class and by ethnic background, but overall, women are really taking over in higher education, and this economy is privileging that. You know, it's also the case that the kinds of blue-collar jobs that men had before that would enable them to make a decent living without a college education have been evaporating. So I think in many ways, the labor market advantages that women have enjoyed because they're better at school are growing, and the labor market advantages young men had of, you know, a strong back and blue-collar opportunities have been shrinking, and so they're having to scramble to catch up. Now, in the middle class and the upper middle class, young men have been headed in the same professional track as young women. So these are very class-bound metrics, and you have to break them down to see what the driving force is. It isn't always just gender. It's how the labor market opportunities by gender have changed.
That's really interesting because the cultural narrative is that, you know, we coddle our sons.
Well, certainly there are many people who feel they do. They do their, you know, that women from the very beginning are incorporated into the domestic economy more. They learn how to do the laundry. They learn how to cook. They have more life skills than young men. And I think there's probably some truth to that. I don't think we have fully adjusted to how to raise sons so that they have some of the life skills that their sisters have. But I do think there's so many complicated ways in which the gender pattern falls out. But your caller's not wrong that there is a gender gap.
Well, and it's interesting in your book, too, as we said earlier, you looked at several different industrialized countries, not just the United States. And it seems like especially in Japan and Italy, Catherine, they're worried about the young men.
Yes, they are, because they're more accepting of the idea of young women being dependent and within family households. They're not at all accepting of that idea. It just flies in the face of every image of masculinity. Now, one of the things I found really fascinating about Japan is their particular moral explanation for why their sons are damaged goods, are just behaving badly. And they do have a very non-economic explanation. They don't look at the economy at all in explaining what happens to their kids, which is surprising because Japan has been in the economic doldrums for more than 20 years, and their newspapers are filled with articles about the lost decade. So it's not like people are unaware there's been an economic problem and slowdown in Japan, but they don't draw on that as an explanation. So why are their sons doing so poorly? They often say it's the absent father. Now, what absent father? Japan has no out-of-wedlock childbearing at all. So who are these absent fathers? They are the fathers who were working every hour that God made. in the salaryman mode that's so famous in Japan, where they're working 70, 80 hours a week. They don't come home. They're out with their male friends after work, which is a cultural pattern in Japan. And now people are turning around and saying, you know, that absent father who was out there working all those hours, the moral center of gravity in our families somehow evaporated when that became the norm. And that's why our sons aren't behaving appropriately. They weren't raised right.
Wow.
I found that completely fascinating because this is a dialogue we hear in the social sciences about poor families in the U.S., absent fathers. These are absent fathers for a different set of reasons.
Fascinating. Well, let's take another call. And I want to return to Italy and Spain in a minute if we could, though, because it's different from Japan. But let's go to Amy waiting in Sugar Hill. Go ahead, Amy.
Good morning. I find this discussion about gender interesting, and I do think there is a deeper question of values here. And I don't think we can underestimate the reality of privilege versus not having privilege. We don't value low-paying service jobs as much as we should in this society. I think when I was younger, I mean, it was expected that when I graduated college that I wouldn't have that job that I was reaching for right away, and that there was value in participating in having a low-paying service job, and there were a great variety of these kinds of things, not just flipping burgers. And I don't think that the value of living at home is so bad. As long as the future is pursued, it's not delaying the future. You know, the purpose would be to pursue the future. And that we do need to pay our dues, and that one way, if our generation, the next generation, is allowed to do that, then they help to create future society by doing that.
Real interesting. Amy, thank you very much. And I want to pick up on one thing she said, Catherine, and I have heard this from nurses, from teachers, from other professionals, you know, who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s. They do feel like younger entrants to those fields do not want to, as she said, pay their dues. They want the great job right away. You know, no thank you for low wages and long hours and working your way up.
You know, I think there probably is some truth to that, that expectations have risen with the demands for higher education. I think the older generation, I include myself here, have long felt that our young people ought to be aiming high, that it's part of the reason that we worked as hard as we did to make those opportunities available for them. I think there's less confidence that starting at the bottom will actually produce a life at the top. I think there's a lot more anxiety about being blocked at the bottom. This isn't true in every occupation, but it's true in many. I mean, I'll just choose my own occupation. When I started out the long road to becoming a professor, you know, there were tremendous opportunities, not easy ones to get, but if you did work hard and you were fortunate, not just successful, but fortunate, you could look forward to a stable career. I mean, we've replaced a huge part of the academic labor market with adjunct faculty who are working in seven different universities to try and make ends meet. So working your way up looks more dubious as a proposition. And that's not just true in my industry. It's true in many. So I think what we need to do here is just be aware that it actually isn't an easy road out there. That doesn't mean we shouldn't expect people to sacrifice or explain to them carefully that the world will not be their oyster from the beginning. But the likelihood that the world will be their oyster at all is much more compromised now than it was before. And I think some degree of understanding of how that landscape looks to young people. I mean, my son graduated from college last spring, and only one of his friends in this graduating class had a job. That's not what it was like when your caller set out.
Right. So
it's a tough road right now.
An acknowledgement of that part-time or short-term employment market and that guarantee of, yeah, if you work hard, you will move up. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. You know,
yeah, short time, part term, or no money at all.
It was so interesting for me to read about Japan and the reaction to the accordion family in Japan. And as you described a minute ago, Catherine, they're horrified there. Okay, in Italy, they say, sure. I mean, as you said earlier, 37% of Italian men in their early 30s, we're not talking about 20-somethings here, in their early 30s still live with their mothers. And this seems perfectly fine. How come?
Well, because the Italian labor market is even harder than our own. what happened in countries like Italy was that in the mid-1980s, the government began to pass laws that made it possible for the first time in their history to provide people with short-term, part-time contracts. In the past, Italy was more of a cradle-to-grave employment system. And when those laws were passed, almost overnight, it was young people, especially young men, who got hit with these, you know, really, truly less remunerative and less secure jobs. And that put them in a real bind almost immediately. Now you ask, well, couldn't they just move out and live cheap like we do? And the answer is that Italy is one of those countries that has very little in the way of rental housing. In a weak welfare state where there's very little coming from government to support families, the owner-occupied home is their bank account. It's their savings account. There's not much else. There's a very weak pension system, very poor health care. So your house, your private house, is really your bank account. When that happens, you get very little in the way of rental housing. So if you have a job that doesn't pay you enough to qualify for a mortgage in a country with very little rental housing, with a mortgage system where, which is very different from ours, you have to have about 50% of the value of a home.
Oh, wow.
To pay down, much, much weaker mortgage system, where else are you going to go? There really aren't many other options, and that began the long climb to the conditions that we face now in Italy. What I found fascinating about the Italian case is that here we have a country that was famous for large families, Catholic country, large families. You would expect the older people we were interviewing to be talking about, where are my grandchildren? Where are my grandchildren? Because there aren't any grandchildren being born in Italy to speak of, because these people are staying home for so long and not forming new households. But they didn't. Those Italian women I interviewed, they didn't talk about it because they haven't lost their children.
They were so happy to have them at home.
They haven't lost their roles as mothers.
Well, this is real interesting, and we don't have time to get into it fully, Catherine, but here's the connection that you make in the book. In Spain and Italy and other countries, you are seeing young people stay home, you know, sometimes well into their 30s. They're not going out, as you said, and creating new families. So you have this demographic bust, basically, fewer and fewer children being born. So that hole is filled by immigrants, and that's caused a lot of tension in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. Because those are countries that are not, have not had a tradition of immigration. Our demographics wouldn't look very different from theirs if we didn't have a large immigrant population. Immigrants tend to have larger families for about one generation, sometimes two, and after that, they don't look any different from the native-born in family size. But for a time, they have more children. They're coming from countries where that was the norm. And that is really the reason why the U.S. doesn't have a fertility problem, if you will. But in countries that have not had a history of immigration and are actually rather xenophobic about it, which I would say characterizes Japan, often true in Italy and Spain as well, then what they get are aging populations. They get countries that aren't replacing themselves through birth rates and aren't replacing themselves through immigration either. And all Social Security systems depend on having a larger number of active workers at the bottom than retiring workers at the top. And we can see what's happening in Greece, and we can see what's happening in Spain. These are all countries that are facing very significant financial pressures because they can't fund their retirement.
And they're not replacing themselves through birth rates, partly because
right.
of these accordion families. So these individual private decisions
cycle.
Create public policy
easy.
Problems.
It is a very serious set of policy problems. What I found interesting was that, in some of these countries, this is surfacing as part of, not the only piece, but part of the general anti-immigrant politics, which can get pretty vicious in those countries, because they see that immigrants are having more kids, and they ask themselves, will Italy still be Italy if the native-born Italians aren't having children, but the immigrant population is? What's Italian about Italy then? And this then wraps itself into a pretty complicated discussion. Similarly in the Nordic countries, by the way, where they also, you know, famously egalitarian and open, but not so keen on the immigrant populations they have.
Yeah, I've spent a fair bit of time in France, and boy, the questions there are the same. What does France look
exactly.
like? if we have this large immigrant population. Last question, Catherine, and I apologize if you can be short with it. For those of us with children far from leaving the nest, what are we going to see in the next 10 years? I mean, are we going to see this continued rise in accordion families or some return to that traditional launch from the nest pattern?
I think this is probably here to stay.
Really?
At least as long as the economy is as difficult as it is. I mean, we will see some correction to this if the economy returns to something that looks a little bit more like normal. But there are other trends that have nothing to do with the recession that are pushing this, and we've already talked about them. The demand for higher education, which is not going to get less expensive, I don't think. So I think this is probably here to stay for some time, but, you know, we really shouldn't be in the prediction business. I'm usually wrong when I make predictions.
Thank you so much for being here. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Catherine Newman, again, a professor at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland, author of the new book, The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue the conversation and learn more about what we're planning every day. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.